Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. That welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown. It is Tuesday, January 25th, 2022. And Brian set a tone for our progressive radio program was one of civil discourse, humor, integrity, and intellectual curiosity. This morning, we'll be talking about voting, past, present, and future, among other topics that the Brieflys will bring us. We have five Brieflys gathered today via Zoom and in the Voice of Vachon studios. It looks like you've returned to the downtown location. Yay, I see a thumbs up. Our sound engineer, Captain of the Airways, Truman O'Brien. Welcome, Truman.
Good morning. Good morning.
We also have sitting next to him, musician, poet, former professor, bicoastal transplant from Georgia, Lynn Kerrigan. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Gail. Good job.
Lynn and I discussed what her call name ought to be.
Besides Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman. There it is. That's what I was looking for. We also have with us today via Zoom, activist, leader of Indivisible Vachon, and Clark Kent impersonator, Kevin Jones. Welcome, Kevin. Can you hear us?
Good morning, Gail. Good morning, everybody. Glad to be here on this beautiful Tuesday morning.
Yes, and you must truly, if not from the Northwest, have seriously grown roots here to call it beautiful when we've sat under fog for days now, when we had promised sunshine. I don't know who I'm going to hold accountable for that change, but I'm looking for somebody.
I will have to say, Gail, that there was some years ago now where we were on the verge of setting in the Pacific Northwest a day-by-day rain, you know, the number of consecutive days of rain. Yeah. And I remember at that time I was driving to work from down 405 in Bellevue area. And it was miserable. It was raining and the traffic was crawling. And I looked over to the driver next to me, and the driver had such a look of disdain that I had just burst out laughing. I couldn't help myself. It's like, yeah, that's what this part of the country has. So, you know, love it or, well, I hate to say love it or leave it. Enjoy it because, you know, it'll change. It'll be, you know, that August will come along and we'll be wondering about the heat waves and the air will be full of, you know,
smoke,
our particulates. Now it's so clean and fresh. So I don't know, you know, there's pluses and minuses to everything.
Oh, I love it. I'm with you, Kevin. I am making a concerted effort this year. It was my New Year's intention to learn to love winter. This particular weather pattern is a challenge for me, I find. Bruce Hallman, fondly known here at the Brieflys as a guardian of the galaxy, rounds out our fabulous five. How are you this morning, Bruce?
Just doing well. Talking about fog, I was just out walking this morning with my friend Terry Donnelly, who's a photographer in Dockton Forest. So walking along the top of the ridge there, looking out over Puget Sound toward Mount Rainier, which we couldn't see, by the way, but we knew it was there. And you know, walking with a photographer like Terry, who does just some spectacular black and white photography, really, we were talking about sort of the shades of gray, and there's a beauty in it that you don't get anywhere else. And he was telling me about how one of these mornings last week, when we had fairly dense fog, he was out walking through the Matsuda historic Matsuda farm. And what we've done when we closed the Joy and Heartache exhibit, we had window screens that were done by a local Japanese-American artist on Vachon, Mia Sukuni, telling the story. in graphic form of the Matsuda family. And so we moved them to the Matsuda farm, and they're set outside. And Terry said when he's walking through the fog, and the fog was fairly thick, he would come along and onto these, you know, sort of cut metal sort of screens telling the story of the Matsuda family. And he said it was just magical. So, you know, you can complain about the fog and you can complain about the rain, but there's beauty in it that you don't see anywhere else.
Yeah, we call it Pacific Noir.
That's it. Oh, thank you. Thank you all for your good thoughts on that. I'm usually the one, you know, I usually get after anyone who complains about the weather. So thank you so much. You've lifted my spirits. Go ahead, Kevin.
You know, speaking of fog, you know, there amongst us here, there are boaters and there are pilots. And, you know, fog has a sort of a challenge to both of those pursuits.
Quite a different feel from my standpoint.
I bet that's yes. kept your wings on the ground, Truman.
Currently, yes, but not during my professional life, no. Can I tell you just a very short story?
Sure.
Alaska Airlines.
This is story time at the Brown Briefly before we dive into the deeper topics.
There you go. This is
everybody's turn. Throw your stories out now or never.
This is a real short one. This is when Alaska Airlines first got their heads-up displays. These screens that drop down that you can see through and has all your flight data projected on them. And we had just gotten them, and when we got those, it reduced our takeoff minimums to a very low amount. We had 300 RVR. In other words, we only needed 300 feet of visibility in order to take off. And I can tell you 300 feet is not very far. And the standard takeoff minimums, I think in those days were 600, as I remember, maybe even 700. But we're taxiing out, and there's a United flight that's pulled over to the side. The ground control has him pulled over, and we taxi by him. And when we do, he calls ground and he said, "Hey, ground, how come Alaska's getting to taxi and we have to hold?" And ground goes, "United, what are your takeoff minimums?" They said 600, you know, like everybody has. And he says, "Alaska, what are your takeoff minimums?" And we said 300. And he said, "Roger." That's all he said. He didn't respond to the guy. And we taxed it out. I was the first officer at that time. My captain said, "Man, this system was worth every penny we paid for it, just so that we could do that."
Just for that.
Yeah.
Just for that moment. And you restrained yourself from saying something like neener, 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 neener over
exactly,
the
airway. Exactly. As my daughter said when she came home from kindergarten, "Mom, do you know that neener song?" That was it.
Okay, other brieflies, let us know what's caught your attention locally this morning, and the ever vigilant brieflies. I see Lynn's got something to share with us.
Well, I will have to say I'm going to go out of turn in the sense that this is not local particularly. This is our Vashon time, but I'm going to come in with my Scottish contingent backing me up. Here on the Vashon scene today is actually Robert Burns' birthday. And usually we have a Robert Burns dinner, but of course that's not happening this year. So a crowd of us, a small, tiny crowd, are going to meet at Liza Beulah with our scotch. And in that spirit, I want to say that I caught this incredible topic that was in the Sunday New York Times, where they had that 52 places to visit that are more climate friendly than some of our major tourist points. And I was so excited because this was about the use of hydrogen fuel in Scotland on the island of Islay, which produces some very peaty scotch, about the development within the Bruichladdich distillery, and I know my friends will hasten to correct me when I see them next, but in the Bruichladdich distillery founded in 1881, they are starting a pilot project on that island of Islay to begin using hydrogen fuel and plus a little fuel oil to power its stills. And I just can't tell you how happy that makes me. A little mix of scotch and climate. remediation.
Our sister island in Scotland. Thank you. Lynn. I have Kevin, go ahead, and I have a little announcement to share too. Go ahead.
I was gonna follow on the climate theme from Lynn. The let's see. So in the Washington State Legislature right now, there are is a bill actually to promote the use of renewable hydrogen for energy. And of course, we've talked about that on the show. But the other thing I'll mention is that locally, right here in my backyard, I've been doing some carbon sequestration of my own. There are a number of trees that we removed from the property because they were either leaning towards a structure or had some rot at the base. And those got milled. And some of the smaller pieces I reserved for milling myself on my bandsaw. And so I just got through the Madrona. And I tell you, it's slow going on a bandsaw at home. but the third stack of cut wood for drying is now growing. It's only about 2 feet tall now, but I expect to get up to 4 or 5 by the time we're done. So that's where I'm coming from.
Yay. Oh, lovely. Well, that's kind of segues into my announcement. Some of you maybe have gotten a little flyer in the mail from the Land Trust. It is the annual bare root, native bare root tree and shrub sale. And so you can place your orders now online at VashonLandTrust.org, information at VashonLandTrust.org. And it's quite an affordable way to bring native plants into your landscape, so important for our native bees and other insects and pollinators. They have everything from Doug fir, Western red cedar, and Western white pine to Gary oaks, Nootka roses, one of my favorites, ocean spray, amazing to have that in your yard, and flowering currants, tall Oregon grapes, and vine maples, among others. So if you're interested, it's only the very, very affordable, like 12 trees or bushes, or $12 for a bundle of 5. So really in the range of, let's do this for our island and for the earth. So if you're interested. How anyone else have anything like to share before we dive in this morning?
Well, I'll just throw out that I've been talking about getting our airplane back and doing our annual inspection on it. We are finally finished with the annual inspection. and I've decided that the older I get, that perhaps next year I may hire it done rather than do all of the work myself. Well, I mean, we do all of the hard work and then we have our inspector come in and inspects everything and signs it off. But I'm really considering maybe hiring it next year.
You mean you're saying you do all the maintenance that's required?
Well, we take everything apart and open everything up so that the inspector can do his job. Yeah. So that saves us quite a bit of money with us doing all of that. But it's also quite hard on the body. So I'm beginning to wonder.
Well, congratulations.
Cold fingers against metal at this time of year.
Yeah, this time of year. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Now to move on to our today's scheduled programming and talk about voting, I'd like to start us with a couple of stanzas from a poem by Amanda Gordon called In This Place, an American Lyric. And Bruce Hallman, our guardian of the galaxy, forwarded this to me. This is just a piece of the poem towards the end, but I liked it so very much, I wanted to share it this morning on the air. So reading Amanda Gorman's poem. There's a poem in this place, a poem in America, a poet in every American, who rewrites this nation, who tells a story worthy of being told on this minnow of an earth. To breathe hope into palimpsest of time, a poet in every American, who sees that our poem penned doesn't mean our poems end. There's a place where this poem dwells. It is here, it is now, in the yellow song of dawn's bell, where we write an American lyric we are just beginning to tell. Hmm. And I like this poem for so many reasons. One of them, there was a word in here that I wasn't familiar with, palmoset. I don't know if anyone else is.
Just going to ask.
So I did my usual writerly thing and looked it up in the dictionary. And palimpsest, spelled for our listeners, P-A-L-I-M-P-S-E-S-T, is a manuscript or a piece of writing material on which the original writing has been effaced to make room for later writing, but of which traces remain. So something reused or altered, but still bearing the traces of its original form. And when you break the word down, palimpsest, to its Greek roots, it means something rubbed smooth. Now, if you notice here where she uses it, she says, to breathe hope into this palimpsest of time. And she, I believe, is talking about our constitution, our laws, our guiding principles. Maybe someone else has another interpretation. I'd love to hear that. But I just thought it was so beautiful to think of it as an evolving, the Constitution and our laws and are evolving things that you know, have come to reflect the changes in our culture and our society and in our values. And coming from a young Black woman, that is a significant change, you know, from, you know, she, at the time the Constitution obviously would have been penned, she wouldn't have been considered as worthy of counting as a full human being, let alone getting to vote. So I loved it. I loved this poem, and it gave me great hope in a time which I feel is like, I feel that we're in a serious crisis. Many measures, right now we have a situation where we have the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, and yet we cannot pass the Build Back Better bill, apparently, at least not yet, that will reverse the Trump era tax cuts for the rich and for the corporations they hide behind. It would fund climate change and other social programs that would support and the working class. We can't seem to get that out of the, you know, even to a vote, let alone neither are we able to pass two very popular voting rights acts in the Senate to address particularly access to voting. There's many moves in Republican states to limit access to voting. And we have two senators, Dino, as our own Lynn Kerrigan has named them, Democrats in name only. I love that acronym.
Pretty obvious.
They have scuttled the legislation so far, and I fear for what comes next. My first question is for our historian, Bruce Holman, and I've invited him to give us a little civics lesson. Bruce, from a historical perspective, how big a deal is it to vote? So many Americans don't even bother to do it. Who had it, historically speaking? Who got it, and who might be in danger of losing it? Bruce, weigh in for us.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, it's, you know, it is a big deal. You know, voting's a big deal. And you know, a number of democracies around the world require people to vote. And turnouts are in the 90% for every election. You know, ours, for very hotly contested presidential elections, if we get up in the high 60s, that's remarkable. So it is important for people to vote. And it's the one time that every citizen has the ability to sort of have a voice in what our government is and where we're going. In terms of who has the vote, I mean, it's been an evolving process in the United States. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the original Constitution, only white males who owned property could vote. So, you know, so it was very, very limited and gradually expanded. And perhaps, I mean, a number of times there were attempts and significant sort of efforts to sort of increase the vote. You know, the Jeffersonian revolution of 1800, the election of 1800, you know, saw the vote move to a lot more yeoman farmers, which was the Jefferson sort of party. You know, the 1832 and 36 elections, Andrew Jackson, you know, the electoral base more than tripled between those two elections. And of course, the 14th Amendment, which is in my mind, one of the great amendments of the United States, because passed right after the Civil War. But it basically, you know, forbids the states from abridging the rights of citizens. So it gives citizenships to everybody, to freed slaves, basically. And then later that's expanded to include women and all classes of citizens. But it's very clear that states cannot limit the rights of citizens. And of course, one of those rights is the right to vote. And that's why all these constitutional, all these sort of state limits on voting are going to be interesting when they go to the courts, because the Constitution does not define voting as a federal right. It's a state right. States have the rights to regulate congressional voting, in terms of American constitutional politics. But the 14th Amendment sort of says they don't have the right to abridge people's full citizenship. And of course, part of full citizenship is the right to vote. So that'll be a very interesting test in the court. And of course, you know, the suffrage amendment to give women the vote, the civil rights movement in the 1960s and 70s expanded the vote. So it's, you know, we've seen a continual sort of a progression in American politics to broadening the voting base. What's happening right now is, I think, unconstitutional, and it'll be tested in the courts what Republican, largely Republican legislatures are doing is limiting that right to vote. But it's nothing new. It's happened all through American history. You know, we call ourselves a democracy, but we're a democracy of the chosen who are allowed to vote. And so, you know, I'm very optimistic that the courts, even conservative courts, will read that language in the way that most constitutional scholars read it. You know, quick civics lesson. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Bruce. No, it's very, very, very interesting. I always really appreciate that long view, and to know where we come from helps us know where we're going, I think. So anyone else like to comment on Bruce's thoughts there? Go ahead, Lynn.
Bruce and everyone else, the thing I think about is now the kinds of arguments that are being used to, in my opinion, as well as yours, to abridge the rights of voters of color in particular. And they're doing it by, you know, saying that they believe the election was stolen and from them, and that they believe, without any evidence, that there was massive fraud happening in the various states, and that the states are now just tightening the controls on having free and fair elections. So they're using all the language of freedom and democracy and, you know, protecting people's rights, and yet it is all perverse and disgusting gerrymandering and clearly an obvious attempt to shut down people's access to voting. And I guess I just want to say, you know, when this goes to the court, Bruce, you know, I'm hopeful that they will say, prove it. Prove it that the election was lost and that, you know, you were required to take these measures to safeguard voting. Kind of how do you see these arguments unfolding, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's difficult to know. I suspect, and Kevin, you might want to jump in here as well. I suspect what you're going to see is lawsuits coming into the federal courts brought by interest groups in states against the legislation that's being passed right now. And that's going to work its way up through the appeals courts and, you know, the circuit courts and appeals courts to the Supreme Court. And, you know, I mean, a law that's designed to sort of keep the vote safe, if you will, that's designed to limit people's access to the vote is going to be very hard to justify under the 14th Amendment. Is sort of my sense of it. And you know, I mean, the Supreme Court, you know, found Plessy versus Ferguson, you know, so, you know, that was a different time and a different court, but, you know, you can never really know where a court's going to go. But the language in the 14th Amendment is so clear. Just Google it sometime and read it. It just says no state can abridge the right of a citizen, and it defines everybody as a citizen. So, boom, you know, not a lot of wiggle room there. I mean, constitutional scholars can deal with that more directly than I can. But my sense is we're going to see that working its way through the courts. Yeah, true.
Yeah, I'm just saying Section 1 is the one that defines it, and it's a very short paragraph. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdictions thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within his jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So there you go.
Yeah.
Pretty clear.
Yeah, coming.
And interesting topic and so many different aspects of it. One aspect is redistricting and basically arranging the boundaries of legislative districts so that your preferred party's candidate wins more easily. It's very interesting to follow that for me. I'm looking at a website from 538, who erroneously predicted the outcome of the 2016 elections, but their analysis right now on redistricting says there are five states where the Democrats have made progress in terms of electoral advantage, and only two states where the Republicans have gained electoral advantage. Of all of the states that have completed their maps, seven of them are under litigation. So, you know, we talked about the role of the courts and intervening, and that is happening on a very large scale. Washington's maps are yet to be finalized. I'm not quite sure what the exact steps are, but early February, in like the first week of February. And at that time, I expect the analysts will take a look and see where Washington ended up in terms of, you know, where it's either balanced, which our independent commission strives to be, or whether it's favored one party over the other. So that's just one part of it. The whole thing about voting turnout, you know, I've knocked on doors and to get out the vote and talk to people who say, you know, we just don't vote. And thanks for stopping by.
I read that
as people who are not seeing the relationship, between their lives and their vote. And that can be because of privilege, or that can be because you feel abandoned. And I think a lot of people probably feel both, right? That they don't really need to participate. Another aspect of voting when Gail Tarleton was running to unseat Kim Wyman, our Secretary of State, who's now gone on to the Trump administration, by the way, and we have now Democrat Steve Hobbs in that seat. I asked Gail, what is she gonna do to make voting easier in Washington, given how easy it is? You get a ballot, you fill it out, you put a stamp on, you drop it in a drop box, you drop it in the mail. She said, we need to educate the people of Washington State who weren't here during the time that our voting got so easy. They bring with them their perception of voting difficulties in the state from which they came. And we need to let people know that you're in a new world now, and voting is not only easy, 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 but something that you really should re-engage with.
Thank you for that. Yeah, Lynn.
Gail, I was kind of perusing some quotes on voting from Martin Luther King. I don't know if you have another section sort of coming up, but I wanted to speak
to
that.
Can you hold those for a moment, Lynn? And maybe
I
kind of like to wrap things up with poems when we get to the end of this section. Will you hold on to that for a second? And can I ask you another question instead? You are a longtime activist. You grew up in the South, is my understanding. What memories do you have of the voting rights struggle in the South?
I was sort of there, you know, from age 2 to 30. And so I kind of grew up under serious Jim Crow laws. I was in Decatur, Georgia, which is about 6 miles. It's almost exactly part of Atlanta now, just due to the east, 6 miles from Atlanta. And you know, blacks at that point could not be on the sidewalk with white women, and they had to lower their eyes and couldn't look at anybody that was not black. There were segregated water fountains and restrooms and backdoor entrances, and there was no struggle when I was a young child. It sort of ignited around those, you know, 1954 civil rights, not the 64 civil rights, but the Brown versus Board of Education. I think that's what I'm headed toward, in 1954, where schools were going to be desegregated. And then the South kind of really was on fire. And there were, you know, several different parties of the African Americans, you know. So I remember reading and hearing about the Students for Democratic Society and the NAACP, the National Association for Colored People. And, you know, all of a sudden, the organization among blacks and the insistence on their rights just kind of hit the front page news every night. And there were terrible, you know, incidents of violence in Georgia, where the governor of Georgia, who ran a Lester Maddox, who ran a restaurant in Atlanta, was famous for sort of holding a club outside his restaurant and refusing to integrate, just as George Wallace refused to integrate the Alabama schools without federal interference. And, you know, there was Malcolm X and there was Martin Luther King. And the dialogue really caught on fire and by this time I'm, say, a senior in high school, and had a wonderful government teacher who was teaching us about our government by looking at what was not happening for a significant part of our population, that they had not been welcomed to vote, that their votes, in fact, their very lives were threatened. Lynching was still happening, you know, into the late 50s in Atlanta. And, you know, then we started watching all the sit-ins that Martin Luther King organized, and the March on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. So for me, it was formative, you know, just to see such incredible injustice and to see such valiant standing up for rights. And at times these were joined by a lot of Hollywood celebrities and by Bobby Kennedy and, you know, some of the Northern political, quote, the Northern agitators, you know, that's how they were sort of shouted down in the South. But for me, it was a flaming example of how to be strong for what was right and for what you believed. And my parents were not from the South. They were from Seattle and Ohio. So there was not a lot of overt racism in our household, for which I was really grateful. We certainly enjoyed a lot of privilege, but it was just this striking, pivotal moment that for me is sort of being echoed right now, you know, after the murder of all these black men are continuing by the police, and, you know, that people are finally standing up and saying, no, you know, we deserve justice under the American system. And it made me become a social worker. I joined the Young Democrats at that time and was sort of trying to figure out how to, I didn't know it then, but kind of be an ally and be a teacher and be an activist myself for civil rights. So, you know, then it began to bleed into, you know, gay rights and women's rights, and the whole human rights movement kind of took off. And I think we hoped after the Voting Rights Act of 65, or whenever that was passed in the Johnson administration, I believe, I think we really hoped that there was significant progress that had been made and would be made, and even after segregation. And we come to see that there are still people who don't want blacks to vote because they don't tend to vote Republican. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you for that. And Lynn, thank you just for being there and witnessing that, sharing that with us today. I think it's so valuable to have firsthand accounts. And I really appreciate you sharing that. I'm going to move us forward just a little bit on what the outline, because I want to get to Kevin. Kevin, you have your fingers on the pulse of current day voting issues. What are your thoughts, and what do you think the future of voting holds? You know, push it out there 5, 10, 20, 30 years. What do you think the future holds with that? And do you have any thoughts on ranked choice voting?
Well, I'll take the latter first, ranked choice voting. Maine, I believe, now has ranked choice voting. I'm not sure at what level. I believe the Senate race was subject to ranked choice voting. And so there's a number of benefits. First of all, there's an obligation on the voter to do more than just pick one candidate. although you're not required to, you know, it's who's your first, who's your second, who's your third. And ranked choice voting allows you to go through the entire slate and give them hierarchy, if you will, you know, priorities. The beauty of it is that if your number one candidate was not, didn't win, then your number two candidate is allowed to then enter into the process if there was no clear majority winner in the system. And so what it tends to do is it allows you to take that risk to vote for a candidate who might be less well known, but who you are passionately supporting, and not waste your vote, because while your vote for that, your number one candidate may not have been counted, your number two vote will be. So you know, it's a good process from that perspective. I think voting rights, you know, Bruce and I had a chance to talk something about the state of our democracy last week. On Voice of Vashon, you can find that show from our Indivisible Vashon meeting. But there's a lot of talk right now about reducing the magnitude of the Voting Rights Act that we're pushing through Congress. It's not clear to me that there's going to be bipartisan support for very much, but whatever can be done should be done. I was just looking at the Biden administration, for example, is suing Texas and Georgia over voting laws. So we need to work in that aspect of the courts as well, right? And I suspect that'll be more prevalent as more states release their maps. David Domke of Common Power, David is a former UW Communications Department chair, is now working on voter education and mobilizing volunteers. His view of voting rights is that we're not going to see the pendulum swing back towards more liberal voting rights until a successful movement like we saw in the 60s, this time led by Stacey Abrams and Reverend Raphael Warnock of Georgia. Who knows what will happen there? But a lot of people are very disturbed by the Democratic caucus not coming together to address the filibuster to advance Voting Rights Act. Senator Sinema has been censured by the Arizona Democratic Party as a consequence of her vote. A lot of people are very stirred up, and I think that we should be. It's a bedrock of a democracy, and voting rights needs to be preserved and expanded, and hard to tell where it's gonna go from here, but stay tuned because you're gonna hear more about it.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Kevin.
I have a quick question, and I'm thinking about ranked choice voting. I think it's a brilliant idea. My question is, if we have such apathy now for voting, when it's pretty simple, you say, I want this person or I want that person, how do you think the electorate is going to respond to ranked choice? I mean, will they respond positively to it, or will they say, oh, it's just too complicated and I can't do that? Question.
Yeah, good question. And my understanding of ranked choice voting is you're not required to rank all the candidates. So in other words, it doesn't require a voter to do more work than the current system. Those voters who feel that why bother because my candidate doesn't stand much chance, I think says, okay, my vote's gonna count one way or the other, whether it's my candidate or my second choice or my third choice. So those voters who would otherwise be deterred, I think, may be willing to come back to the voting table. It is hard to know, right? That's why it's important to keep statistics on the number of participation and correlate that to the changes made in the process. But yeah, good question. We really don't know. We just are speculating at this point.
Yeah, both, if I can jump in, both Australia and New Zealand have rank ordered voting. And one of the things that I do when I take students to Australia and New Zealand is I go have the Electoral Commission, the Australian Electoral Commission, which is an interesting concept. Australia has an Electoral Commission that runs all elections. So all elections are run by a non-partisan Electoral Commission. That's a government agency, but not partisan, sort of separate from the government. And runs elections all over the world, not only in Australia. But, you know, with rank order voting, when we run students through that process, we do a mock rank order voting. It's, you can just see their eyes light up. It's sort of, oh yeah, I get it. And my sense is in Australia, you get what they call a donkey vote. You know, some people just write FU on the ballot and turn the ballot in, or they'll just, you know, draw a big X on it, or they'll turn it in blank. You know, the requirement to vote in Australia doesn't require you to fill out the ballot. It just requires you to be there and sort of be checked off. So, but that's a very, very small percentage. You know, a quarter of a percent of votes come back as donkey votes. And so I don't think, as Kevin mentioned, I don't think it will deter people from voting.
Yeah, my thought is that it may even encourage people to vote because they feel like it's not just a lost cause if they want to support a candidate that, you know, doesn't really have a chance of winning, you know, but they really, that's where their heart is. Lynn, we're winding down to the last couple of minutes here. Would you like to share your are they quotes by Martin Luther King,
yeah.
I believe?
Yeah, they are, sure. He said a lot of amazing things, so I'm sure I'm going to leave out something that somebody particularly loves. But a few of them that I think are important is that he believed that voting is the foundation stone of political action. He says that the vote is the most powerful instrument ever devised by human beings for breaking down injustice and destroying the terrible walls which imprison people because they are different from others. He talked about our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. And, you know, the one that a lot of people know is injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. I think I'll finish with rereading Amanda Gorman's poem. There's a poem in this place, a poem in America, a poet in every American who rewrites this nation, who tells a story worthy of being told on this minnow of an earth. A breath to breathe hope into the palimpsest of time, a poet in every American who sees that our poem penned doesn't mean our poems end. There's a place where the poem dwells. It is here, it is now, in the yellow song of dawn's bell, where we write an American lyric we are just beginning to tell. Thank you, everyone. It's a lovely morning with you.
Thank you,
Gail. Happy fog day.
Yes, and we will see you all next week.
Bye-bye.